I'm Kenny Wetler-Jones, and you're listening to The Project. In the last episode, my co-producer John joined Lawrence Carter as he walked 3,500 miles around the coast of the UK.
If we look back at how fast things have changed with wind power, it's basically been 10 years really where this has really come through. Perhaps the same thing can happen with electric power and diesel vehicles in 10 years.
In this episode, we're continuing to stay close to the shore. Wave Energy has long promised a lot, and there have been a number of seemingly successful pilots, but as yet, nobody has managed to deploy at scale. To understand more about this, I travel to Copenhagen to meet Erik Friis Madsen, inventor of Wave Dragon. Erik picks up the story on how he came up with his approach to harnessing wave energy.
Lying on a beach, I noticed the waves rolling up the beach, and it's easy to see if you lie flat on your stomach on a beach that the waves run up higher than the highest wave tops out there, and so that's a simple principle.
The other inspiration for Erik's design of a wave power system was film he saw of atolls in the Pacific. Atolls, in case you don't know, and don't feel bad because I didn't either, are ring-shaped coral reefs that encircle a lagoon, sometimes partially, sometimes completely. And interestingly, the process by which atolls form was first described by Charles Darwin, based on observations he made during a 5-year voyage aboard HMS Beagle from 1831 to 1836. Anyway, I digress. Back to Erik.
You know, atolls on top of volcanoes, ring-formed beach where the waves over top run into the lagoon and then leaves again through a hole in the reef. And so I said, just put some turbines in the hole. And the next thing was, of course, that this had been tried in Norway with waves running up on a rock coast where there was a lagoon, and they put a turbine in the outlet from the lagoon, and then that works quite well. But there's so few places in the world that you can utilize such a technology. So the next thing was that it should be floating. And so Wave Dragon is essentially a floating atoll with a lagoon with some turbines in the outlet.
So before we go any further, it's important that you get a picture of what this thing looks like. We've included some images in the show notes at gridlines.com/podcast. Take a look if you can. Wave Dragon's commercial director, Taus Norland, picks up the explanation.
It's really like you take a bathtub and put it in the water, and you connect a ramp to the bathtub so you actually have waves like an artificial beach overtopping and, well, filling up the bathtub. Then you pull out the plug of the bathtub and put in a hydro turbine. And the simplicity of gravity makes the water seep towards the sea surface, and it's guided through the turbines, and hence it produces electricity. So you could even say, well, Wave Dragon is hardly a sort of wave energy converter. It's really a floating hydropower plant.
Throughout our conversation, Taus and Erik were keen to reinforce that this is not new technology. It's just a new way of combining long existing technologies. As they say, it's just a big bathtub with turbines in the bottom. In 2003, they built a prototype and conducted a successful pilot.
It was put in the water in 2003 as the first offshore grid-connected, or the first floating grid-connected wave energy device. And it ran for 20,000 hours grid-connected. And as I think Taus explained, that we had our troubles and we solved them. And so it worked, and it proved the laboratory. We have tested 5 years before that in the laboratory scale. And all the results were improved when we went up in scale. Wave Dragon is floating like a hovercraft on air cushions. And air cushions get softer the bigger the device gets. So it will stay much more calm in the sea. And when it stays calm in the sea, then the waves can roll up the beach just as a natural beach. If it moves with the waves, really nothing happens. So when you go up in scale, it gets more efficient.
And this scale point is critical to Wave Dragon. It's been one of the stumbling blocks to the development of full-scale power plants using the technology. Unlike solar panels and wind turbines, it's not possible to start small. But also, the returns to scale are much bigger. So on the one hand, a stumbling block to development, on the other hand, an opportunity.
But the funny thing about wave energy is that if you scale up two times and in all directions for the upscaling for the device, and you go up to twice the size of waves, moving to a more a powerful wave climate, then the power goes up 11 times. So you upscale two times and you get 11 times the power. And that's completely different for wind turbines, of course, because if you scale up two times, you only get four times as much power. And that's actually very difficult for investors to comprehend, because they say, why don't you do the same as the upscaling of wind turbines? But the small wind turbines of 20 kilowatts, they produced actually power at a reasonable price. But the power cost for our pilot plant was maybe 10 times as high as, or 50 times as high as a small wind turbine. And that's due to the nature of the upscaling increase in power. So you cannot sell these small devices. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's just for testing, actually.
So is the goal of wave energy even worth pursuing? Yes, says Taus, the opportunity is also large.
If we look at the world market today, the international institutions doing research on sources of renewable energy and sort of electricity consumption across the globe, they say the technically exploitable wave energy on a global scale, if that can be utilized completely, it's almost four times the current global consumption of electricity, which can be supplied just from wave energy. So there's really limitless opportunities for the wave energy technologies.
Given the apparent scale of the opportunity, I was keen to understand the wider status of the wave energy market. And so I headed off to Edinburgh to speak to Richard Yem, the inventor of Palamis, a completely different approach technologically, and one which also ran a pilot test but was not able to develop at scale. Richard told us how a chance encounter in his final year at university changed the course of his life.
I was persuaded to go to a demonstration of a wave tank in the University of Edinburgh, where Stephen Salter, who is often seen as the grandfather of wave energy, had set up this amazing facility to model the ocean waves in the Atlantic in order to develop his system, which was the Edinburgh Duck wave energy converter. And I was persuaded to go, and I nearly didn't. But I walked through these double doors, and it really was a sort of sliding doors moment, if you like, in my life, which was I walked into this laboratory full of incredibly intricate, complex laboratory instrumentation to test out wave energy concepts. And of course, I just fell in love with the place. I just thought, this is actually what I want to do. A mixture of technology, the sea, invention, challenge. This looked absolutely fantastic. So I put two and two together and basically did a project to tank test yacht hulls, linking my sailing to this amazing facility, and look for ways of making yachts sail faster through waves. So not wave energy, but very much the same sort of kind of technological aspects. But then after that, just a loop back to some people I met while doing that PhD, I got involved in wind energy. Renewables was really just coming. This is the mid-90s, so renewables was really just opening up. And somebody I'd met while doing my PhD said, I've got an interesting technical problem with a wind turbine. Do you want to come and help me solve it? Which we did. It was a vibration problem with some wind turbine blades. And it was really through that association that they told me that wave energy had now become a supported technology within what was called the Scottish Renewables Obligation, which was the renewable support scheme at the time. And he said, look, you had all these great ideas for wave energy converters. Why don't you commercialize one of them? And so I looked at the opportunity and I sort of kind of saw it as a real sign that wave energy was no longer going to be a sort of academic curiosity. It was going to be a mainstream technology. And so I said, well, why not? So I took some of the ideas that had sort of had been sown and had sort of gestated from that PhD period and chose the Palamas concept, this articulated line absorber concept, as the most promising, and started a company then called Ocean Power Delivery. And that was really the start of the journey. And the next 17 years was a sort of roller coaster ride through the development and proving of that system.
So Richard assembled a team and undertook the numerical and structural modelling to put together a business case for Palamas. They did a friends and family round of funding and obtained some grants, culminating in putting together a demonstration model which they tested in the Firth of Forth near Edinburgh and, as it happens, very close to my hometown.
And that did create the platform and the enthusiasm within the venture capital community to invest. And we secured a £6 million investment from a consortium of venture capitalists. And, you know, that, if you like, allowed us to build the first full-scale machine, and then we attracted a range of different investors, which we can talk about, in order to take the technology through to the point that we had 15,000 hours of at-sea demonstration, 250 megawatt hours of actual generation into the grid still, from offshore waves, still a world-leading figure. And, you know, and really get to the point where we were very close to having a system that could have been commercially viable before we were unable to secure further investment and unfortunately had to put the company into administration. But it was that's a very brief summary of 17 years of work, 750 engineer years of development that went into the system.
I put to Richard the point that the Wave Dragon guys had made, that one of the challenges that wave energy needs to overcome is that inability to start small and scale up, the way that wind and solar has managed to do. And that this creates a capital intensity that makes projects hard to develop when there's a perceived technology risk.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely it's a major issue for wave energy, is that the waves themselves don't scale. The waves that have energy are the big, long-period rolling swells out in the ocean. Not the sort of short, splashy chop that you get from the wind that's blowing on the sea where you are right now. It's the big, powerful swells that build up over hundreds of kilometres out in the ocean. So, and they don't scale. The wavelength is the wavelength. And the machine that you make needs to react against those waves if you are to absorb any appreciable power. So, yes, you need to sort of start big and go big or go home kind of approach. Now, that is simplistic. There are different concepts which are able to start smaller and grow. But at the end of the day, waves are big and long, and the machines to capture them are likely to end up being big and long. So that certainly creates a capital intensity which wouldn't have been there at the start of wind energy. I mean, you can have wind turbines just half a metre in diameter. Not the case with wave energy.
Go big or go home. As we heard earlier, Wave Dragon had the same issue. Here's Eric again.
The Danish wind turbine industry, it was a huge success from the start when we exported 20 kilowatt turbines or 22 kilowatt. And the next step was 55 kilowatt turbines, and we exported thousands of them to US because they had some tax incentives over there. And still, Wave Dragon's wind turbine industry is world's biggest. It has been a huge success story, and everybody tells us or asks us, why don't you do the same? And that's the thing. We cannot scale up in small steps. We need to go for the big device. And as we are a small company, I think it's difficult for investors to believe we could do it. But we started really from scratch, and we made this prototype, and it works. And it's not a technical problem to scale up 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 times from that, because we have all the technology at hand.
Given that wave power needs scale and scale needs capital, the failure of the Palamas pilot was a big setback to the industry. They were seen to be the leaders at the time. Eric and Taos at Wave Dragon mentioned to me that this has been a stumbling block for them developing their technology. Perhaps a lot more reticence for investors to try again, given the Palamas experience.
The industry went through a big reset. It was obviously a big shock to the industry. You know, Palamas, so we were very much in the lead. There was a lot of hopes pinned to our success. I think the investment of on other technologies, there were a few other leading ones around, but investment in other technologies was now about, we've got a better wave energy converter, a much more familiar investment case, in fact, than the Palamas. And then when we went under, of course, it caused, you know, a lot of issues for investment in the sector in general. And something that I feel responsible for and at least accountable for is that I think that did damage the investment case for wave energy.
In the years since these pilot projects were undertaken, the world has changed. The cost of onshore and offshore wind has reduced dramatically, perhaps making it even harder for wave energy, with its perceived technology risk and capital intensity to compete. I wondered what the pitch is now for wave energy.
I think there are some quite interesting angles that can be explored. One is offshore renewables is going into deeper, rougher water. Floating wind is becoming a major proposition in a number of markets which don't have, as the UK and a lot of Northern Europe has, shallow, relatively sheltered water for fixed offshore wind. Floating wind is coming. And I think wave energy could very much form a symbiotic relationship with floating wind in that they both need to reduce cost, both need to demonstrate a trajectory to convergence with conventional renewables, and they can help themselves do that. And also, because floating wind is an emerging technology, hasn't yet perhaps put itself into a straitjacket of certification, which would prevent you adding new technological elements to it at this stage. So I think there's a window of opportunity there.
The relationship between floating wind and wave energy is one that Wave Dragon is also exploring.
You can get much more power out of a given sea space if you do both wind and wave power. And the power quality would go up because it's much more consistent if you mix wind power with wave power. So we just need the big developers to catch the interest for wave. Now they're so focused on wind, and that's okay. But if you go to deeper waters with floating wind, we can really compete with floating wind turbines, because floating wind turbines are actually quite difficult to construct. They also need to stay calm, and you cannot have a lot of pitching of the towers, and that's really a problem. But if you put wind turbines on board a wave dragon, you don't have that problem, because it's very calm in the sea from the beginning.
So perhaps the advent of floating wind may be the market development that wave energy needs. Having learned from the Palamas experience, Richard's company Quotient is now focused on helping other companies active in the sector learn from the mistakes that Palamas made.
The industry is understanding that perhaps the biggest challenge in wave energy is that machines have to survive in conditions which are several orders of magnitude more arduous than the conditions in which they must operate normally. I mean, typically in an ocean site, Atlantic or Pacific, the wave energy machine must be optimized to absorb and generate power from waves which have an average power of about 20 kilowatts per meter of width. So still quite an intensive resource, but we're talking about waves that are a couple of meters high, 100 meters wavelength, rolling in from the sea. But then take that same piece of ocean, and in a big storm, you will have you'll have an average wave height of over 10 meters, perhaps 15 meters. You'll have individual waves within that can be as high as 30 meters, you know, several stories high, traveling at 40 miles an hour with an instantaneous power of perhaps 20 megawatts per meter, 1,000 times higher than that typical operating state. that that's a significant challenge. And it's one in Palamas that we said you're not gonna create that set of conflicting requirements just by throwing steel at the problem, like the oil and gas sector can with oil platforms, like the marine industry can with shipping. We need to solve this at a conceptual level. We need to have a system that can be a very big, well-coupled, powerful, dynamic absorber when the waves are small, but become progressively invisible when the waves are large. That's probably the biggest area of opportunity for the sector, is elegantly solving that problem.
As well as solving the conceptual problems, Max Karkus, who was Business Development Director at Palamas, says that the government support model is crucial. In particular, says Max, what the industry most needs is a feed-in tariff regime that's supportive of marine energy development.
To me, that's the single most important thing. It's that market signal, because it's the market signal which drives investment, private investment, largely. You know, all of these things are driven by private investment. Government support in you know, grants, whatever, is of course, you know, important, but it's private sector investment which is the big thing. In my time at Palamas, we raised £42 million of private sector investment, most of which came from overseas. We had £10 million of government grants, and we generated £20 million of sales. So just £10 million spurred, you know, quite a lot of inward investment, because most of that investment came from overseas. The good thing about a tariff, it's a success-based thing. You know, if you win and you deliver and you generate electricity for a new technology, this is in particular, then you'll get the benefit. And if you don't, the only people who lose are the people that invested and invested in the projects. So it's been historically the case with all these technologies, whether it's wind, solar, you know, you've needed are kind of a tariff, an electricity tariff that motivates that investment. And if you look at these technologies, there's never been a new energy technology that's been economic out of the box. You've always needed a kind of feeder market for that to gain a foothold. I mean, in the early days with coal, you know, you had electricity prices back then in today's terms of probably the equivalent of about £1 or £1.50 a kilowatt hour. Now those prices have, of course, fallen dramatically. The same has happened in wind, where costs have fallen probably 80, 90% from the 80s. Solar, of course, just continues downwards on its trajectory. And there's no reason why that wouldn't be the case in something like wave energy.
And if these kinds of problems can be solved, the opportunities could be huge.
If we look at the world market today, the international institutions doing research on sources of renewable energy and sort of electricity consumption across the globe, they say the technically exploitable wave energy on a global scale, if that can be utilized completely, it's almost four times the current global consumption of electricity, which can be supplied just from wave energy. So there's really limitless opportunities for the wave energy technologies.
So although dismissed by some, I'm inspired by guys like Eric, Taos and Richard, who are pioneers in a sector that has the possibility to supplement the energy revolution we've seen from solar and wind. We're going to continue to follow the story of Eric and Taos as they develop Wave Dragon, and so we're going to be coming back to this topic in future episodes. For show notes, go to gridlines.com/podcast. The Project is an independent podcast produced by Kenny Whitelaw-Jones and John Jorstad. Special thanks today to Eric Friis-Badson, Taos Norland, Richard Yem and Max Karkus. Today's episode was edited and mixed by Bren Russell. Show notes and links can be found at gridlines.com/podcast.